Welcome to Monday, the 12th of June. I'm Bill Radke. What a show we have for you this hour. We're live tweeting at KUOW. Sherman Alexie will be here in a few minutes. God, I love his writing. He's got a new memoir I think you're going to be glad you heard about from the source. And I've always wanted to meet my first guest, Steve Ballmer, former Microsoft CEO. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Bill. Pleasure to be here.
You still live here?
I
on
do,
the east side?
Absolutely.
And we invited you here because you've got a lot going on, but Well, look up at our TV monitor. You know, you can. Our American government is the thing we're thinking about these days, and you can argue all you want, Steve, about government. But what's the point? Everybody has their own opinion. You have facts.
Well, obviously, people are entitled to their own opinion. It is often helpful for people to be looking at real numbers, real context, and then forming an opinion, as opposed to having a doctrinaire opinion. It's also interesting, I think, when you pressure test what people think, they'll say, no, I think this is totally screwed up, and I think this is totally fine. And it may be something like, hey, on a base of 100 and 101, that's what we disagree about, is about a 1% change. So really having context, I think, is important to ground these discussions.
We're talking about your website. It's in beta now, it says, usafacts.org, and I'm looking at it right now. And you start out, you say that this is our nation in numbers, and you start with the Constitution, which gives us four missions: establish justice and ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. And then it's numbers time. Why did you arrange usafacts.org like that?
Well, I'd actually played around with a lot of organizations, but they tended to be one level down. And when you go through usafacts.org, you'll actually see all of those: child safety, immigration and border security, et cetera, et cetera. But having 16 things is simpler than the hundreds of things that people associate with government. Still too complicated. And then one of the guys on the team had written something that started with the Constitution, and all of a sudden the light bulb went off for everybody and said, well, absolutely, that's what government's here for. And we just lined everything up with the preamble to the Constitution.
And what does that preamble have to do with the numbers that that follow?
Well, in a sense, if you think about business, at least in the context that of a business, it takes in resources, it spends those resources, and it achieves some kind of outcome. Now, you know, it's market share maybe and profit in the business case, but we take in taxes, we spend the money, and citizens expect outcomes. They expect to be healthier, wealthier, more secure, you name it. Mm-hmm. But the question is, in what roles does government play a part? And the preamble to the Constitution lays that out for us. And then everything government does, we felt you could categorize nicely into those buckets. So we have 14 little sub-buckets. Life expectancy, promote the general welfare.
Mm-hmm.
Health, government promotes health.
Visas granted, but here's a number, 9,932,480. Is that a lot? I don't know. What do I do with that number?
Well, we provide context in there. There's 330 million Americans. We show you how many people come and go. If you look at that visa number and you want to go one layer below, we'll show how many of those are visitors' visas, where people are just coming in and going right back out of the country. The bulk of those are visitor visas. Second biggest category is people who emigrate to the country to live with their families. You can get down to, you know, like Microsoft would be concerned with, which is high-skilled labor. That's a few hundred thousand only out of 9 million. My wife and I were talking about refugees. I think if I remember correctly, that's thousands or tens of thousands. And it gives you a context in a country of 330 million people, exactly who's coming and going.
But do you have a political agenda that you would even realize or admit to in choosing to focus on, okay, how many people coming here by visas are actually in this category, this category, this category?
No, all that data comes directly from our government, statistics provided by government. People can decide, hey, look, we take in too many refugees or too few refugees. We're silent on the point, but we'll give you the number, and then you can decide in context. My wife and I were talking about, you know, there's a cost to take in refugees. Well, no matter what the cost, if you multiply it by a small number, It's a small number in the context of $5.4 trillion spent by government.
But you chose to talk about that fact. You chose that number to highlight. You could have highlighted others.
No, we put it all in context. Okay. We didn't pick one number versus another. We show all of the numbers of people coming out in and out of the country.
Yeah.
People have to make their own choices after that. You know, in terms of things I care about, one, I care about the facts. I think it is helpful to ground discussion in the facts, and I'm a pro-facts partisan, if you will. Number two, as a business person, the notion that we run deficits as a country forever is a little confusing to me. Society can solve that in a number of ways. Raise taxes, lower expenses. I'm silent on that. I'm just one of 330 million people, one of a number who get to vote. The country will decide.
You're silent on the on how to reduce the debt, but some economists, they don't all agree on how important the debt even is.
And
so
in the country, you asked what I'm part of. It doesn't make sense to me. So I will from time to time say, geez, I wish we would balance our budget. You asked me what I'm partisan on. I think that makes sense.
Okay.
The other thing on which I'm a partisan is to work to ensure that all kids who are born in this country have an opportunity to realize the American dream, that they're not shut out from the chance to advance economically relative to their parents on the day that they're born, particularly relatively. I mean, if the economy grows, can they grow faster than the economy based upon where their parents came from? I think everybody deserves, every kid deserves that opportunity. I wear that on my sleeve. That's where my wife and I are involved in terms of both philanthropic work and civic work, because it'll take government systems reform also in addition to philanthropic support in that area. So I'll wear that on my sleeve, but I don't think it in any way gets in the way of being, you know, sort of just the facts man.
A numbers guy.
On the TV show Dragnet.
You're listening to Microsoft, former Microsoft CEO, Steve Ballmer, owner of the LA Clippers, which we'll talk about in a moment. But you mentioned you were a fact partisan. When you say USA and facts these days, a lot of us think Donald Trump, alternative facts, fake news. Is your website in any way a reaction to President Trump?
No. We started working on this I started a little bit in 2014. We really got our team ramped up in 2015 a little bit, and then the end of 2015 for most of the work. So well before the election or any of that, I thought it would be a valuable thing for me, and it might be interesting to some other people. And we were off to the races.
Well, you've run a big company. He's running a big country. Do you have any opinion about how Trump is doing that you want to share?
No, as I say, I'm a pro-facts partisan, and it's important for every citizen, every voter, to form an opinion on that. We're trying to give people the tools to go to work on that. Where will the country wind up on some of my issues, like balancing the budget? Not clear yet. Mm-hmm. Not clear what the Congress will do, the president. One of the things you learn when you get into this is there's a lot more authority vested in states and local government than I might have thought. When you read the newspaper, you think all the authorities in the federal government.
Right.
A lot of the authorities actually vested in the Congress, not all in the presidency. You know, our forefathers really believed in balance in government and representation to get there, and it really shows.
Again, Steve Ballmer's website is usafacts.org. So let's take defense spending, which you show on the website how it's changed over the last 37 years and how much that takes up of our overall spending. It doesn't tell me, of course, why we're spending more, whether it's inflation or politics or changing threats. So what do you want me to do next? What do you suggest I do to better understand what your defense spending number means and what I might do about it?
If you dig in, and we got plenty of data in the appendix, I encourage you to read the long form of our annual report. What you will see is a couple things. You'll see how capital spending has varied compared to personnel spending. So how much is going into planes, ships, how much is going into bullets and other sort of expendables, how much is going into soldiers. You can take a look at that. Soldiers is down quite dramatically. If I remember correctly, we're down from about 2.1 million warfighters, as they're called, to about 1.4 million warfighters today. More money going into capital, into those parts of warfare. You see the numbers. We'll give them to you back to 1980 on the site. You can see they do tend to spike when we're involved in military conflict, as we were in the Gulf War, as we have been in Iraq and Afghanistan. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion upon whether those are good actions. You know, what should you conclude? Exactly what you should want to conclude, and that and that'll vary by person. Some people say, hey, look, I'm really pleased to see the number of warfighters going down. Some people will say, geez, I wish total military spending will go down. Some people will ask the subsequent question that says, what is the current status of our planes, ships, et cetera? Why are we buying new ones? We don't have enough data yet in the site to assess that, but we'll go find what else government has to offer, because we only use U.S. government facts.
What do you conclude about the poverty rate of 14.8%, and is there anything you hope we conclude about that?
Well, poverty rate, again, it's been pretty static. It's up a little, down a little if you look historically. And I think the second important thing to look at is how has the buying power, counting government transfers, of people in poverty changed over time. We have some of that in the website, and people can say, hey, poor people are poor people. Poor people do have more buying power today than they did formerly because of government transfer programs. So there's been, in that sense, a step up. Some people will say, hey, look, that's enabling in a way that sort of disincents work. But people can all take a look at that and see how much is that. We show you exactly what the dollars transferred are per person in poverty, and people can develop a point of view about that. The point of view that is most important to me is that if you are born in the bottom quintile in this country, depending upon where you are born, who your parents are, what your race is, what your ethnicity is, it can vary from as little, you can have a 27% chance of staying in the bottom quintile. 20% is perfect, if you will, because 20%, 20%, et cetera. And yet for some people that, you know, African-Americans in this country, that number is 50%. That can't possibly be okay. It's also high for Hispanics, for white people living in certain locations. And I think it's really important to get after that systematic poverty that affects children.
On KUOW Seattle, this is former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer. A couple more questions about your website, usafacts.org. Is it fair to count the number of gun deaths when you can't count the sense of, for example, safety that gun owners feel? Getting at numbers in some ways, that does that tell the whole picture to you?
We provide all the gun data we can.
Okay.
The actual gun ownership data and the number of guns in America is not counted. That is not a statistic you can get from our government. And so there are estimates. We don't provide estimates unless, you know, because they're not official government numbers. So how many people own guns? Not known. How much more secure do they feel? I not surveyed, so we're silent on the topic. How many gun deaths are there? You can take a look at the numbers. Some people say, if I remember off the top of my head, it's something like 16,000 gun deaths a year. About half of them are suicides. About half of them are homicides, if I remember off the top of my head the data. And you could say, or I might have wrong. It's either 16 or 32,000. I can't remember. It's one of the two numbers.
I'm searching. I'm searching, and you're sitting there with not looking at a computer at all. You are a numbers guy.
I'm pretty sure it's either 16 or 32. It's a binary number, 16 or 32,000. But you can take a look at it and say, that's a small number in the context of all deaths in the country. And you can look at that number and say most all of those deaths are needless. And say, hey, look, even more than you know, even one or more is senseless. And everybody will draw their own conclusion about that. I wish there was more data about gun ownership, et cetera, but by law, I don't think the government can collect that.
You stand behind the credibility of all your sources, including the government?
No, we only use numbers that are published by government in America.
Should I trust those numbers? Is that a pro-government statement?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, look. Do I think that there's integrity in that process? Yes. Do I think it's perfect? No.
Okay.
You know, why would we not believe? And if you can't believe in the integrity of the numbers government publishes, then that should be job number one for every American, because our government's supposed to be making decisions based on those numbers. And if they're not credible, that should be the first priority of government, is to get them right.
Let me link numbers and basketball. Do the numbers tell you how good an NBA owner you are, or how effective a Microsoft CEO you were?
Well, sure. You get a gauge from numbers. The thing you don't get a gauge on from anything, you can get a gauge about how you did in the past. You don't have a gauge on how well you might do in the future. There are ways to run companies where you look very good, and yet when you leave, the tank is empty, if you will, and things fall apart. There are ways to run a company that look good and then things succeed. There are ways to run a company where they never look very good economically, but they're positioned for the future. I would say that's kind of a number of the tech companies today with very high valuations. Mm-hmm. I'm proud that we were able to grow our profits quite a bit, leave an asset that looks pretty strong, and I love the fact that my kind of successors at Microsoft have done such a good job with the company.
Steve Ballmer, a former Microsoft CEO, you bought the Los Angeles Clippers about 3 years ago, which came as a shock to some Sonics fans. Now Seattle's talking about bringing the NBA and NHL hockey to town. You've got a big smile on your face. So let's talk NBA basketball in just a moment with LA Clippers owner, former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer, and one of the biggest basketball fans I know, National Book Award winner Sherman Alexie, is going to join us in a moment.
Fun.
Stay tuned. KUOW Seattle.
Got some basketball beef, gotta get off my chest. Ain't no basketball team in the Pacific Northwest. We got football, baseball, and that's sport we do tie. But with no Supersonics, we just sit around and cry.
We're back with former Microsoft CEO, now owner of a basketball team, the Los Angeles Clippers. Steve Ballmer is with us, and literary treasure and Seattle basketball lover Sherman Alexie. Welcome, Sherman.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here with Steve. I was actually in Key Arena yesterday.
Why?
So to do the Seattle University commencement. So I was so sad and depressed. I was excited to be at the commencement, but it felt like I was in a giant funeral home as well.
Why is that?
Dude, come on, dude. They're going to fix it up.
I know.
Get excited.
But I mean, the Sonics weren't there. I kept glancing over. My eye line was right to where my seats were. So I was just incredibly depressed. So I'm still depressed. I'm going to be one of those old Brooklynites 70 years after the Dodgers left, still bitter and angry.
Well, let's talk about whether that's going to happen. First of all, we're going to talk about Sherman Alexie's beautiful new memoir in a few minutes here, but we are talking Sonics now. Steve Ballmer, you were part of the effort to bring the Sonics back to Seattle, but you pulled out of the Soto Arena investment team 3 years ago and bought the Los Angeles Clippers. And when someone asked you how you feel about leaving the Sonics team, it sounded like you were angry, and then you pulled back from it.
It is really unfortunate that the greatest city, you know, in America doesn't have a professional basketball team. So I still hope that happens.
Are you passionate about the NBA coming to Seattle?
I'd love to see the NBA back in Seattle. I don't know when and how that might happen, but I'd love to see it happen.
Can you do anything about that?
Well, I actually retain an ownership position in the land in Soto.
Okay.
For full disclosure, if you will.
Does that mean you are part of the investment team trying to bring the Sonics here?
No, okay. Not because I own another team.
Yeah.
But I am trying to make sure that if that land is needed for a stadium, people can use it. Now, with the announcement of the plan to fix up Key Arena, it may not be, but they still have to get the permitting done there. There at least are options then, because a stadium obviously is a requirement.
Yes.
To eventually get a basketball team back in Seattle.
Does the NBA, how much more does the NBA want a brand new stadium equal Soto right now versus how okay do you think the NBA is with expanding and putting a team in the Key Arena?
Well, at least the way the rhetoric goes, I would say the Key Arena will be an all new arena. I mean, it may still
be a new arena under the roof.
It may still be the Key Arena, and it may still be in the same location. It's a little bit like saying, you know what, the King Dome was blown up, and I guess Quest Field was built pretty much on top of maybe Safeco, I can't remember which. It's the same place. It's just a totally new facility. And for all intent and purposes, I think people are talking about a very, very, very different facility than the old Key Arena.
Sherman Alexie, Soto or Key Arena? Or do you care?
I don't care. either is fine. I think in terms of political environment, though, that the Soto Arena has a harder time.
I certainly don't care. As a landholder, I don't care. I'm going to sell the land. I just want an arena to get done. I worry a little bit about Key Arena because all that traffic that's emerging there through, you know, let me call it Amazon country, if you will. But, you know, I think the fans deserve an arena, and whether it's Soto or Key, you know, the key is to get the hockey team, I think, first and then get going.
Yeah. That's one of the things that got me excited, though, being in the Key Arena now is going to be in the middle of this massive tech neighborhood and a walkable neighborhood that I was hoping that having a new arena in Key Arena would make that even more walkable and so that traffic wouldn't be a problem if you've got 25,000 more fans in apartments in the area.
Sherman, do you want Steve Ballmer to do what Clay Bennett did to Seattle? Steve, take your Los Angeles Clippers and move them here. You own the thing.
No, I don't want that to happen. In fact, when it was happening with Sacramento, I was opposed to it.
LA has another team.
I don't want to do to another set of NBA fans what happened to us. I think it's immoral and hypocritical to be a sports fan that way. So I'm highly in favor of expansion, but it would have to be some incredible circumstances for me to even be able to stomach taking another city's team.
And you've said you're not.
He's going to have LeBron in 2 years.
Well, I love to have LeBron.
Is that true?
The Sherman is rooting us on.
Is this the NBA rumor mill?
No. Well, there was a little rumor that he would move to LA. Okay. But you know, the thing for me is, will expansion happen? It's not been discussed with the owners since I bought the team. So, if there's not going to be expansion, which there might not be, then the
just to bring everybody along, the expansion means the NBA would have to add another team, and that's not happening.
You can't ever add one; you have to add two.
Got
to
add two.
Odd numbers are bad in sports.
Okay.
So will the league add
Seattle and Bellevue?
There you go. I don't know. It's not been discussed.
Okay.
Teams moving. I'm with Sherman. On the other hand, there are cities that have a very hard time supporting a team for a variety of different factors, and who knows what happens over time.
I think the only team I could possibly support just based on watching their crowds in the arena is getting the Atlanta Hawks. What? Seeing the empty arena for a good team.
Yeah.
You know, you see empty arenas when the teams are bad.
Yeah.
You see empty arenas if the teams have been bad for a long time. But the Hawks have been a solid team for a long time and have never had that big fandom. So if it does happen, if Atlanta came for sale, you know, I might get hypocritical.
But how confident are either of you, talking with Sherman Alexie and Steve Ballmer, how confident are either of you that Seattle would support the Sonics at that level, that the most passionate, the Sherman Alexies of the world, you believe and want to believe, we're a Sonics town, just bring them back and we'll really love them this time. How confident are you really that that's true?
That the city would re-embrace?
Yeah, Atlanta's not, doesn't seem to be embracing their team. What if Seattle's moved on?
Atlanta's a tough professional sports town. It's not just basketball. They have some of the same issues in other pro sports in Atlanta. And nobody's quite sure why, but everybody's quite sure it's an Atlanta-wide problem. Look, Seattle supported the Sonics when they were here. Seattle will come back out and support a basketball team if you know one can come back here, which I think would be great.
Did Seattle support the Sonics enough, as much as it would have taken?
Well, we had a bad team near the end there, and then when the Thunder ownership came in, they made sure the team was worse, and they made sure to alienate as many season ticket holders as possible. So I testified to this in a court of law. So
court of law? Why?
I was part of the trial. I was the expert in heavy quotation marks.
Why are you an expert?
For the season ticket holders.
Oh, I see.
And
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to stand down on most expertise.
Yes. Yeah. Well. And the joke is, you know, if they wanted to win, they shouldn't have had an Indian testify. You know, if it had been about fishing rights, we would have had a chance. But basketball, nope. So I think it'd be huge here, especially with the change in the environment. Seattle has actually become more of a diverse city. That neighborhood is browner. There's more money. I think there's a younger set of people, and I think the Warriors have energized the league in a way, Steph Curry in particular, in a way that I think we'd have a much stronger base of younger fans with more disposable income.
You know what feels strange about the Key Arena plan? Jerry Bruckheimer, the producer of Top Gun and Pirates of the Caribbean, when Seattle's mayor is selling his arena plans by bringing in a Hollywood producer, it seems like Seattle has changed.
No. The mayor's not selling his plan with a Hollywood producer. There's a Hollywood producer who wants to own a hockey team.
Uh-huh.
And if you want to own the hockey team, then you have to be part of building an arena. So you got to follow the hockey fans with money. And I think that's the path in, as opposed to, hey, we're going Hollywood, we're going hockey, seemed to be the tone of the announcement for me, which is great because the arena will get built.
And I, you know, speaking of away from basketball, with Key Arena, you know, I would love for better concerts to be in city. I mean, that trek down to White River is a marathon. So I would love to have a world-class concert facility with amazing acoustics so that we attract that larger group of music stars into the city. So there's more than just basketball about making Key Arena a better arena.
What are the odds Key Arena gets renovated, NHL hockey comes, NBA never comes?
Non-zero. Look, never's a big word. I would never bet on never. The real question is, if you say the next 5 years, if I was a betting man, I'd say there won't be basketball in Seattle in the next 5 years. If you say next 10 to 15 years, then I start being a betting man that there will be basketball back. And if you say next 20 years, then I say, yeah, probably basketball's back. Now, it depends on your time frame. You know,
I'm not a young man, Steve.
I bought the Clippers when I was 58, and those sounded like long time horizons for me to wait to own a basketball team. On the other hand, if you're my, you know, 18-year-old son, I'm pretty sure you'll be enjoying professional basketball in Seattle.
It's like light rail for him.
I also suspect, and I know Steve can't answer this question or talk about this, but I suspect there's going to be a far more developed minor league basketball system. I think there's going to be A, AA, AAA, the equivalent of minor league baseball. I think that's going to be a stronger and stronger possibility. So I think we're going to end up with a AAA equivalent basketball team here in Seattle before we have the Sonics back.
Care to comment, Steve Ballmer?
Well, I think that's certainly possible. I would worry that Seattle fans would feel disrespected by getting a minor league team first.
Oh, would you feel disrespected?
No, because then we'd have a team with, you know, I just thought of like Gonzaga guys who didn't quite make the league yet, or UW guys, or, you know, I think much in the way that in the early days of the Women's Professional League, the ABL, the not the WNBA, the other professional league. I know geography was a big part of their plan. And I think if minor league basketball worked on geography, I think you definitely have crowds.
Uh-huh. All right, leaving aside basketball now, I want to end our time together by bringing the two of you together. We started, Steve Ballmer, talking about your website, usafacts.org, and Sherman came in, and your reaction, Sherman, was
narrative wins. No matter if the narrative is a lie, I mean, everybody's a literalist. Human beings are built to be literalists, and actually numbers end up being poetry. Facts end up being poetry in the human mind. And what I thought it's beautiful what you're doing, Steve. And I thought, and it's going to fail. That's what I was in the green room. It's going to fail. Human beings are awful. I went through like 9 different emotions listening to you talking about facts.
Well, let me say it this way. If we only get 6 people who really like what we've done, I'll still feel good about our work. That's number one. I'll feel better, of course, if we get many more people than 6, but I know we've done good work and I know it's an important thing. And, you know, in a representative government, somehow these things will sort themselves out. It may take longer than it takes to get, you know, a basketball team back in Seattle, but people do get these things sorted out, and they are ultimately grounded in numbers. This is the thing I you know, when a budget gets discussed, over time, it eventually is, do we want this number to be 100, 160, or 0? I mean, whatever the number might be. Those are real numbers. When parents are assessing their kids' school, they do know what the test scores are at their kids' school. So people may not love the facts, but ultimately they decide the numbers. and they can assess some numbers. The crime rate. What's the crime rate? What's going on with the crime rate? You know, there are assessable numbers. Now, will that guide who people vote for? Who knows? I'm not going to make that assertion.
Yeah, I mean, I think about in basketball with the advanced stats that are available now and how many old-fashioned fans are still wildly opposed to these stats that truly reveal who you should be signing. And I know the Clippers use stats. I know there's a number – the best teams in the league year after year now are using these advanced stats, and the teams that struggle don't use them. So Ballmer is ahead of the stat game in basketball as well.
We're together on that. Steve Ballmer, Sherman Alexie. Sherman, will you stick around and talk about this book?
Yes, I will.
You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Steve, you don't have to say you love me, but I want to say it's good to finally meet you, and I'm glad your wife is such a KUOW fan.
She really is.
And good luck with the website, usafacts.org, and with the Clippers until they play the Sonics. And it's good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Nice to meet you, Sherman.
Thank you, Steve.
It's KUOW's The Record, back in just a moment.
I want to see the Northwest with a hometown team. Dunking balls through a net would be a lifetime dream. Got no basketball, some that just don't fly. Throw a chair in the air if you're as pissed as I.
Bring the Sonics back home, it's not a move we'd regret. Anything to see some balls stuffed in a net.
Oh yeah! Oh yeah!
KUOW's The Record on Twitter, at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke now, continuing my conversation with National Book Award winner, poet, novelist Sherman Alexie, whose new memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Sherman, you ready to make a U-turn from the NBA?
A screaming U-turn.
Yeah.
From the minor league joys and terrors and fears and doubts of getting the Sonics back to my incredibly difficult relationship with my mother.
Well, thank you for writing about this. Your memoir on one level is about Lillian Alexie. So will you start by just telling us a little about Lillian?
Well, Lillian Alexie was my mother. She died in July 2015. She was a Spokane Indian, one of the last speakers of the old Spokane Indian language. It's been revitalized and is being taught again. But she was one of the last old-time speakers with a direct connection to the language and the cultures from time immemorial. One of the spiritual leaders of the tribe, but she was also, I think, undiagnosed bipolar. She was a chronic liar and manipulator. She was mean and sometimes violent. But she's also the woman who sobered up when I was 7 years old, which saved us.
Yep.
She's also the woman who was the drug and alcohol treatment counselor for our tribe for many years, who saved the lives of dozens of my fellow tribal members. So she was an incredibly complex, arrogant, opinionated woman who sucked all the energy out of every room she walked into. I have no idea why we didn't get along.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. The word you use a lot about your mom is cruel. And when you picture her being cruel, what are you picturing?
Obvious lies. I'm thinking of one particular instance that's not actually in the book. She was over here with my sisters visiting us here in Seattle from the reservation, and I drew her a map. This was in the days before the internet. And I drew the greatest map in the history of the world with exact mileage and with landmarks and signs and bus stops. I mean, this was a work of art. I can draw if I take my time. And I took 2 days to draw this map, knowing they would have to make one right turn onto Martin Luther King and then a left on Pine to get to us. And so they went to a powwow and they came back that night. And my mother, on purpose, kept not making that turn. Even though the map was in front of them. And my sisters fought her 3 or 4 times as they went in a circle. But then they stopped. They just let her be who she was going to be, and she kept not making that turn. My sister's getting more and more angry but inverted, and me at home knowing what she was doing. And I kept thinking, she's not turning on MLK. She's not turning on MLK. She's not turning on MLK. So that's what I mean by the cruelty she was capable of on even that basic level of not making a right turn from the map I gave her.
That was not the example I expected from you, because
Well, it could be her throwing the pop can in my head when I was a kid and knocking me out. It could be the time I was weeping because my father was gone on another alcoholic drinking binge, and I was weeping, and she threw me outside onto the porch and locked me out. and she tried to let me back in later, but I decided to sleep in the doghouse with our mutts instead. So it all blends together. Mm-hmm. It's the way in which cruelty can be everyday, ordinary to spectacular, but that it's a constant possibility. So that her unpredictable nature, her amazing beauty and magic, combined with her ability to be so mean.
Yeah, and that was always there.
Right.
Yeah. And yet, as you say, you write so beautifully about what I would call acts of love. That scene of her making quilts, you know, with those fingers to keep food on the table and being in the front row of your readings, even though she felt ashamed by some of what you wrote, and letting you leave the reservation when you needed to. Why wasn't it those acts that stood out to you the most?
Well, those are in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think I didn't give precedence to anything.
Yeah.
I didn't value anything over. I tried to present the full complex portrait of her, and I don't spare myself either.
No, you don't.
You know, because at some point, she was a bad mother for many, many years. But at some point, as I became an adult, I chose to continue to be a bad son. At some point, I was equally responsible for the pain in our relationship. Whether that was at age 18 or 28, I don't know. But at some point, I was equally culpable for the things that went wrong inside our relationship.
That's something so many of us can relate to. Why do you think you were that way?
I am a world champion grudge holder. I'm mad at things that happened when I was three, not even doing with my mom. So I think part of it is simply my personality and hers. I think we are both world champion grudge holders.
Why did you let your father off so easy compared to your mother?
Because he was easy to love. He was a gentle person, calm, quiet, introverted. And I think one of the big things that inside a warrior culture, like my tribe, like in the Native American world, which is so focused on warriors of the male and female variety and military service and the canonization of war heroes of the past in the military for the United States government and in the Indian battles against the United States government. I think the canonization of that fist, arrow, bullet, that in the midst of all that, my father was so passive and so gentle. I think to have a masculine presence that was so kind was such an antidote, such a revelation, so refreshing, and it felt so safe for so many people, not just me. In working on this book and talking to friends and family from those years, so many kids, I say kids, they're all my age now, but so many kids remembered our house as being the safe place to be. And in the book, I call it my mother's angry sobriety and my father's drunken kindness. And I think that combo is what made it safe. My mother provided the structure and my father provided the love.
But has that flipped now? I try to think of love as something you do, as how you come through for somebody. You know, how did you work through that from wanting to feel safe, little junior, to now?
That's a fascinating question. That's just killing me right now, Bill, because the thing is, when you talk about acts of love, about the act of doing something that's going to protect a child, my mother did that.
That's why I ask.
My mother had the jobs, and my mother provided the money. My mother was predictable. As I say in the book, my mother was industrious.
Yeah.
And my father, on the other hand, was a random alcoholic. So when you talk about the very act of proving love, my mother did it time and time again, and my father was completely unreliable. And yet, I spent most of my literary career canonizing him and writing about him and believing that he was the primary source of my storytelling. But in working on this memoir, I've realized that that's not true, that my storytelling, my connection to our past, my intensity, my discipline, my soul, my anger, my rage, my everything intense about me that creates the storyteller is primarily from my mother.
And even her not teaching you the ancient language, she says, Junior, English is going to be your best weapon.
She always said that. She said two things to me always. Junior, English is going to be your best weapon. And Junior, you were born with a suitcase in your hand. Is that not handing your child a vision?
Yeah.
Is that not predicting my life? And my mother did that.
Would you mind, we're talking with Sherman Alexie, whose new memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Would you mind reading the eulogy you delivered at your mother's funeral?
Yes, here it is. I said, my mother and I had a difficult relationship. We weren't always kind to each other. So it's good to hear how kind she was to some of you. But it hurts, too, to hear that she mothered some of you better than she mothered me. And it was also good to hear how mean she was to some of you, too. I knew the mean Lillian maybe better than all of you, maybe even better than my brothers and sisters. My mother was good to people, and she was mean to people. And sometimes she was good and mean to the same person at the same time. Anyhow, that's all I really have to say. I am not a traditional Indian. You all know that. I don't sing or dance or do the ceremonies. I don't pray like other people pray. I just talk. So I'm really going to miss talking to my mother. I am really going to miss her voice.
You put that in the book, but then you seem really, in the book, very uncomfortable about that.
I didn't tell the truth. I mean, I just glanced off the truth. I looked at the truth with my peripheral vision. I didn't give her the eulogy that was honest and completely accurate and didn't give her the eulogy she deserved. I mean, this book is that eulogy. I gave the simplest possible version, the gentlest possible version of a eulogy. And it wasn't honest about the heights and depths of knowing Lillian Alexie and being her child. I didn't do that, the extremes. And I spend most of the memoir trying to tell the honest eulogy.
It was eulogy-sized. It was simplified, but why do you say not honest in its leaving out the extremes?
I mean, I didn't talk about the time she threw the can of pop and hit me in the head and knocked me out. I didn't talk about the time she left me on the porch to sleep with the dogs. I didn't talk about the ways in which she quilted for 3 days straight to finish a quilt so that we would get our electricity back in the middle of winter.
With arthritic hands.
Yes, I didn't talk about the hours and hours she would spend working with the elders, working with kids, working with drug and alcohol addicts. I didn't risk the judgment of my fellow tribal members in trying to tell the full story of this human being. I failed as a son, I failed as a eulogist, I failed as a human being in that moment.
Wow, Sherman. Okay, I want to, I haven't asked you about this, if you want to talk about this. Such an important part of this book is the connection you make between rape and legacy. Are you comfortable revealing the part that played in your family?
Yeah, here? I can do that. So,
and it could be a way of setting up, like you wrote this poem called Ancestry, which is a long poem for radio, but I thought maybe you could read a part of it, but it needs a setup from you about what you knew, what you learned.
Well, just to speak in larger terms, when you're talking about Canada and the United States, when you're talking about the most vulnerable group of people, it is Indigenous women who are subject to the most oppression, the most violence, the most sexual violence, and my mother was not spared from any of that. My big sister is the child of a rape. So my mother was raped, and my sister Mary was conceived by that. But also my mother was conceived by rape.
I should say, this was not your father, this is your half-sister Mary.
My half-sister Mary, yeah. So the rapist I'm not related to. And my mother's father, biological father, was a rapist who I'm also I won't reveal his name. It's not the fault of his children and grandchildren. It was his crime. And my mother, in telling her story and talking about her life, apportioned it to her children. So we all have different parts of her life story, different versions. And I'm the only sibling that she told that she was the biological child of a rape. My sisters didn't know that. My brothers didn't know that. She never said that to them. She only said it to me, and she told that to me in my teen years. And looking back, I think it was her damaged way of asking me to be a better man. I think it was her dysfunctional way of warning me about how Native women are treated and how Native men and non-Native men can treat Native women. I think it was her way of talking about her pain. And she knew I was leaving. I was gone from the reservation already. I was going to a white high school, and she knew I was going to live this larger life. And I think it was her way of telling me to honor women. And I also think in some ways it was her way of wanting to be remembered, her own strength. I mean, I tell you, this book is very difficult, and there's a lot of difficult stories I tell about my mother, but she'd be very proud to be on the cover. And despite the pain, I know she'd be sitting beside me signing the book. My wife, who's Indigenous, told me the other day that her mother, who passed away, her mother and my mother are probably in heaven clicking their false teeth in celebration because there's this book about this amazing Indigenous woman in all of her complications. And the most tragic and terrible complication is the rape. And so I deal with that in various ways inside the memoir. I try to do it in a respectful way, an honorable way, as much as you can about something so terrible. But this poem is about me grappling with what it means to be the brother and the grandchild of rape. So I'll read from the poem.
Yeah, an excerpt.
The poem is called Ancestry. My late mother is the grandmother of this poem. It is her descendant. Disrespectful enough to reveal that my late mother was conceived by rape, that most vicious of amendments. Unlike me, this poem will question my late mother about her conception and self-conception. I'm sorry to interrogate you, mother. I know you're the victim and should be treated with respect. But there are things I'd like to know. When did you first learn you were the child of rape? Who told you? Why did they tell you? Should I even call him your father? Nobody wants to be known as a rapist's daughter. I should tell everybody you were raised by a good man named James, and not by your biological father, yes. Are you angry with me because I've revealed what you chose to conceal? I'm sorry for this intrusion. But I need to know if you saw the rapist's face when you looked into the mirror. Did your mother see him when she looked at you? Is it possible that your mother loved you less than your siblings because of how you were created? Did you ever learn how to be anything other than devastated? Okay. Stop, Sherman, stop. I want to stop this poem and drop the facade.
And then Sherman, this talking with Sherman Alexie here, the poem goes on to say that rape is our ancestor. I mean, you widen it out beyond your family.
Well, the genocide of Native Americans wasn't just about murdering the body, murdering the culture, murdering the language. It was about murdering hope. It was about murder and rape. It was about violence on all levels. And when we talk about colonization, when we talk about boarding schools, when we talk about invading armies on reservations, when we talk about church and business and government, when we talk about the Dakota Pipeline, even now, what are we talking about but the capitalistic exploitation and violence and murder and rape of the human body, the human soul, the earth, and the ways in which for indigenous people all that is connected. The land is us. We are the land. So when you're polluting and violating and exploiting land, you're doing that to us as well. You're doing it to everything we hold sacred. So my mother and her mother, in being raped physically, were also raped spiritually. They had salmon taken away from them by the Grand Coulee Dam. They had their entire history shrunk by being placed on a reservation. And despite all that, their love is shown through. Despite all that, I'm here, my siblings are here, and we're pretty good people. And I love my siblings. I love my brothers and sisters so much. And I love their wit, and I love their passions. I love their weaknesses and their strengths. And I love how we've been able to love one another even through all the destruction that's happening now and the destruction of the past. And it's our love that's going to carry us through.
Sherman, at one point you wrote that you don't know whether you loved your mother or whether she loved you. How do you feel today?
At the moment, of course she loved me. Ask me 10 minutes from now. One of the things I'm realizing is that this book was just the first step of a ceremony, and now that it's going public, it's hitting the shelves tomorrow, the audiobook and ebook as well tomorrow, that now I'm entering the second half of the ceremony, and that's going to involve just as much listening as it involves talking. My friends and family who have read the book are already beginning to tell me about their relationships with their mother. Some great. It's so amazing to hear the stories of amazing mothers, great mothers. And it feels like science fiction, like Good Mother by, you know, Isaac Asimov. And it feels utopian.
Magical realism.
Yes. But also hearing about difficult mothers, difficult parents from people who I wouldn't have thought had come from the same kind of environment as I did, who I'd only thought of in terms of their privilege, but who in fact had just as much pain as I did as a poor res kid.
Sherman Alexie, National Book Award winner, poet, novelist. The new memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, and I'm looking at the clock. We have just about 1 minute left. I wonder how you're doing. The listener might wonder, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I've been in therapy for a long time, and I'm properly medicated, folks. So I am feeling the emotions I'm supposed to feel, and I am not judging myself for feeling them.
Thank you for writing it. I just loved reading it, and but I guess that's about all I can say publicly. But I'm glad you're in the world. I love your writing, and thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Writer Sherman Alexie with us on KUOW Seattle. And thank you for tuning in. And we'll be back at you with another show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.